Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics Iowa style and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Leading Heartland. Laura, as always, it is good to be with you.
Yes, good to be here.
This was a big day for both of us and for the state. The first day of this year's legislative session in Des Moines, and it was the day leaders in both the state Senate and state House made speeches about their priorities, and some of them, well, all of them were quite interesting. Laura, let's start with what you heard and saw today in the state Senate.
So the Senate Republicans are excited about cutting taxes. They want to have significant permanent income tax cuts, not just a one-year check back to people refunding with the extra money that's in the surplus. And the number two ranking Senate Republican, Jake Chapman, said that they really need to keep their eye on the ball and focus on a goal of permanently eliminating the income tax so that Iowa can be like South Dakota and other states that have no income taxes.
So Jake Chapman, who is the Republican Senate president, Republicans hold a majority in both the Senate and the House, said some specific things about teachers and the press being part of a sinister agenda. This is a very strange thing, it seems to me, to be saying on the opening day of a session. What did he say? And have you ever heard anything like it before?
I was a little surprised by this because last Tuesday there was an opening, a pre-legislative forum, and the top two Republicans in the Senate weren't there, but the third ranking Republican, Amy Sinclair, was there. And she struck what I thought was a little bit more of a conciliatory tone on education. She was talking about, well, you know, we're just going to be giving parents a little more information. But Jake Chapman, who in November made a lot of news by talking about how he wants to create a new felony offense for disseminating what he considers obscene material in schools and was talking about putting teachers and librarians in jail. It doesn't sound like he's backing down from that at all. He said that we live in a world in which many, including our media, wish to confuse, misguide, and deceive us, calling good evil and evil good. And as you said, he mentioned the sinister agenda that people want to, in his words, normalize sexually deviant behavior against our children. And complaining that people are disguising what he calls sexually obscene material as desired subject matter and claim that it has artistic and literary value. And so it sounded to me like he is going to push forward on some kind of a bill that would target certain books in school libraries. So, I mean, I did not get the impression last week that there was a lot of appetite for passing that kind of a bill in the Iowa House, but we'll see. I mean, if it's a priority for the leadership of the Iowa Senate, it may happen.
That's interesting. It seems as if the Republican Party in Iowa, based upon what we've heard today and in the past, is on a mission now against the press, against schools. They're making schools a very big issue, perhaps, in this coming election, and talking more and more about parental control over schools.
Yes. And I mean, there's definitely going to be some kind of a bill, another attempt to pass, whether you want to call it vouchers or education savings accounts, something that would allow parents to take public money and spend it to give their kids a private education. There's definitely going to be some kind of a push on curriculum to give parents more opportunities to challenge curriculum or to at least find information about the curriculum and make their voices heard at school boards. So that definitely does seem to be a priority. I think Republicans looked at what happened in the Virginia elections in November, where education was a top issue for the Republican candidate who won the governor's election. And they're thinking that this is going to be a successful issue for them in Iowa as well.
Before we move on to what happened in the state House today, let's stay with the Senate. When we talk about perhaps anti-press feeling among Republicans, we have to mention that last week, Republican leaders in the Senate said they will no longer let journalists work at press benches in the chamber. And that's ending a tradition that has lasted more than 100 years. What in the world is this all about?
Yeah, so this has been brewing for a few months. So last year, both of the press galleries in the Iowa House and Senate, which are right down by the floor near the members' desks, both of those were closed last year, ostensibly because of the coronavirus. But in fact, they had legislative staff sitting at those desks routinely. So during the special sessions on redistricting in October, they did not let journalists sit in those press galleries. And a lot of the reporters who have worked in the legislature for a number of years were agitated about that. So this is something the Iowa Capitol Press Association has been working with House and Senate leadership on for a few months now. And the House leaders did agree to allow some reporters to sit in the press gallery, but the Senate leadership did not. And so the journalists are relegated to this area very high up in the public gallery. And it's hard to explain, but you can't see from where the journalists' desks are. You can't see the presiding officer's chair, that area that's called the well in front of where the presiding officer is. So when there's action going on in the well, when somebody calls a point of order, the journalists won't be able to see what's going on down there. The television and photographers and the press photographers were very unhappy because you can't get good images of people speaking from where the media are right now in the Senate. And generally, the audio quality is also poor. So that's bad for radio journalists and for anybody who's just trying to get a recording so that they can have an accurate quotation later. But the biggest thing is that the journalists lose that easy access to the members. If they want to clarify something from the debate, they can't just make eye contact with the person and have the legislator come over and explain.
I wonder how much of this is spread from the top, from Donald Trump, his years of saying fake news, alleging that every mainstream media source, every allegation against him, though true, provably true, was false. I wonder how much of that is coming downhill from the Trump administration.
Well, I don't know. I think clearly the Republican leadership, they're not happy with the media, as we discussed. I mean, Jake Chapman is not happy with the tone of media coverage. I think part of it is that the Republican majority is very large. They don't feel that they need favorable media coverage to keep power. And I do think, honestly, the part of it is related to my efforts to obtain credentials since 2019. The Institute for Free Speech, which is a national organization based in Washington, commissioned a legal memo about my situation in 2019 and sent it to House and Senate leaders. And one thing that it said was that they can't treat non-traditional media like bloggers different from regular journalists, because if they do that, that creates First Amendment concerns. And that's what the Senate Republican staff said in their somewhat convoluted explanation to the Iowa Capitol Press Association last month. They said, well, we just feel that for a government body to try to define what the media is raises First Amendment concerns. So I do think that in a sense, you could say that they'd rather treat the whole media badly than let a few journalists they don't like in and treat those people fairly.
Certainly going to see how this plays out. And we should say you are going to continue to cover the Iowa legislature, no matter what the Senate or the House do in terms of access.
Oh, absolutely. And I was denied workspace in the Iowa House, but I'm going to keep trying to gain access. I do comply with their policy. And I know that the Iowa Capitol Press Association is going to keep working with the Senate leaders and hoping that they reconsider this decision on closing off the press benches to reporters.
And we should say that we will be here every Monday and Wednesday talking about what's going on at the state legislature this year, as we did last year. We will be talking about all the bills that have been introduced, the major bills. So you can tune in right here on this radio station, KHOI, and listen to us talk about what's going on in a fair and factual manner across the state. Let's talk about what happened in the state house today. Again, it was speakers in the Senate and speakers in the House.
Yes. Yeah, so the House Speaker, Pat Grassley, he doesn't really talk a lot about social issues. That's not his style. And he focused a lot on he welcomed, there have been a couple of new Republicans elected to the legislature since last year's session. He talked about wanting to do permanent tax cuts and not something that's just 1 year only. He did talk about the workforce shortage, and he said that there needs to be a holistic approach to solving the workforce shortage. And the House Republicans have been a little bit more interested in passing bills on childcare. The Senate Republicans haven't picked up a lot of those bills, but Speaker Grassley did talk about childcare again today. And so we'll see what happens. I know that in the governor's condition of the state speech tomorrow, she's expected to talk about childcare as one part of a workforce agenda.
I was just about to ask you, how could lawmakers address that workforce shortage? I know Democrats and Republicans have different views on that.
Yes, they do. I mean, part of the Republican agenda is cutting off certain avenues for unemployment, making it more difficult for people to collect unemployment. But as Dave Swenson, who's an economist at Iowa State University for many years, I mean, he said that only about a sixth of the Iowans who are unemployed actually collect unemployment benefits. So that doesn't really solve your workforce shortage. We have fairly low labor participation rate. We still haven't recovered from several years ago that the labor participation rate. And so making it harder for people to collect unemployment is not really going to get you very far in solving that. So, I mean, the Democrats have talked about of creating higher pay, more easily accessible childcare, transportation. Those are big barriers for people. Of course, raising the minimum wage is something that the Democrats have been trying to do. Iowa hasn't raised the minimum wage.
There you are.
Now. Yep. It's been 15 years since Iowa raised the minimum wage. So Democrats would like to see higher wages and better benefits. They feel that that's a way to get people back to work.
Okay. I think you were frozen there for a little bit on my end. I hope the radio audience heard what you were saying there. So what do you think is going to happen in terms of, we're talking about Republicans perhaps again taking action against mandated vaccine requirements. They are adamantly opposed to it. Are they ready to go farther at the legislative level right now to ban mandates, or are they going to wait a while?
This is going to be the biggest test, I think, of the strength of the business lobby groups in Iowa. The business lobby groups, although they speak out against the Biden administration mandate policies, and I think they'd be happy if the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Biden administration's mandate, which it looks like is going to happen, they don't want the legislature to pass a global ban on businesses requiring vaccines of their workers. So I think this will be one of the most interesting things to watch, because two very important factions in the Republican base are business and social conservatives, and a lot of those are anti-vaccine at this point. And so we'll see who has more power. There is a solid block of legislators in both the House and the Senate who really want to ban vaccine mandates and go much farther than the bill that they adopted in October, which said businesses can have a vaccine mandate, but they have to give people health and religious exemptions if workers don't want to comply with that mandate.
Let's talk briefly about Governor Reynolds' condition of the state address, which is coming up. She's expected to lay out her agenda. What do you expect to hear?
Yes. Well, the first thing that's interesting is that the governor is, for the second year in a row, going to deliver this during prime time. That's very different. In the past, governors have always given this speech at about 10 a.m. And so last year, I think it was due to the coronavirus public health emergency, the governor wanted to do this and televise at a time when more Iowans could watch. But now it seems like this is going to be a permanent part of her office's strategy. So she didn't want to talk about details last week at this legislative forum, which I attended. But she did say that she would be making some proposals on taxes, workforce, childcare, education. Last year, of course, she did support a kind of voucher program, education savings accounts, and I expect to hear about that again tomorrow. She said that she would talk about some things with healthcare and agriculture, but she wasn't very specific about it. So I'm not sure where things are going on that. But the taxes. The governor has had mixed success in getting Republican legislators to accept her approach to taxes. I don't expect her to propose a sales tax increase. In 2019, she had this big tax package that would have cut income taxes, but also raised the sales tax. And I don't hear a lot of appetite among the Republican lawmakers for raising the sales tax. So I think that she may leave that off her agenda.
We'll find out. Let's just briefly go over, let's call it Legislature 1A. How does a bill become law in Iowa? And let's talk briefly about that and the two funnels that are coming up, because that's unusual in some state legislatures, the idea of a funnel. So talk about that.
So we'll talk first about how it's supposed to happen and then how it doesn't always happen that way. But in theory, bills are supposed to work through the committee process. So they all get assigned when they're introduced. They get assigned to the relevant committee, and then the committee chair assigns them to a subcommittee or doesn't. So actually, a committee chair can just vary a bill by not even assigning it to a subcommittee, or the subcommittee chair can just decide never to hold a meeting on that bill, and things can die. That most bills that are introduced never even get to the point of a subcommittee hearing. But a subcommittee, in most cases, has three members. Two from the majority party, one from the minority, needs two votes to get out of subcommittee to the full committee. And then usually by the seventh or the eighth week of the legislative session, they have what you mentioned, that first funnel. The first funnel deadline means that most kinds of bills other than tax bills and spending bills, most bills need to be through at least one committee in the Iowa House or in the Iowa Senate by the end of that first funnel, otherwise they're considered dead for the year. Now, that's the theory. What we've seen is that when the House or Senate leaders really want something to happen, they can pull a bill up very late in the day and they can pass it very late in the session, even if it never went through that committee process. But in theory, most bills that don't get through that first funnel are dead. Then you have a few more weeks, and then there's the second funnel deadline, which means that the full Senate or House has to have passed the bill, and then one committee in the other chamber has to pass it for it to still be a live wire. And this, again, does not apply to tax or spending bills, but it does apply to most of the kinds of legislation. So there's always a real scramble. By late February is usually when that first funnel deadline is. Late March is when that second funnel deadline is. And then after that, the legislature usually focuses on some of the big tax proposals and the budget, getting the budget bills in order. That's what often happens during April.
And we'll be talking about much more of this in the next weeks on this broadcast and what's going on in the state legislature. Right now, it's 15 and a half after the hour, wherever you're listening, and you are in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. We're here every week at this time to talk politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Lots of news last week in the state. Democratic State House member Roz Smith suspended his campaign for governor last week. He said there are barriers that one campaign cannot overcome. Let's talk about that.
Yes, it sounded like he was mainly talking about the fundraising, the financial barriers. It's really expensive to run a statewide campaign. And he had written on my website, and he had spoken to Todd Dorman of the Cedar Rapids Gazette in December about how it was frustrating for him that even though he was working hard on his campaign, he had trouble getting some of the Iowa Democratic Party's major donors to return a phone call or set up a meeting with him. And so that leaves Deidre DeGere right now as the only declared candidate who's actively campaigning. The state representative, Chris Hall of Sioux City, is said to be still thinking about it. I think everybody is waiting to see what kind of a fundraising report Deidre DeGere files. Those are due on January 19th. And I expect actually that she's going to report a pretty big fundraising number. She is very well liked in the Democratic base, and she's also supported by several political action committees, and that may have given her access to a national donor network. So we'll just see. But if she has a very big fundraising number, I think it's more likely that the Democratic primary will just be uncompetitive, because it would be difficult for Chris Hall or anybody else to jump in and get a lot of traction with less than 5 months to go before the June primary.
In another story, retired Republican State Representative Mary Ann Hanusa said she is going to run for state auditor this year in the GOP primary. So that's an interesting announcement.
Yes, and that will not be a competitive primary. She came right out of the gate with endorsements from the governor and senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst. So she's clearly the choice to go up against Rob Sand. I was intrigued because last year there was some chatter about former U.S. Representative David Young possibly running for auditor. But I think that that may have been on the assumption that the current state auditor, Rob Sand, would have been running for governor, because David Young obviously didn't have any interest in running against an incumbent. I'm interested to see what Mary Ann Hanusa can do. She doesn't really have a background. She doesn't have any kind of an accounting background, or she did chair the House Government Oversight Committee for 2 years, but she doesn't have much of a background in tracking state finances. And she, in her past campaigns, she hasn't been a very strong fundraiser. And one thing we know about Rob Sand is that he raised about $2 million for his state auditor campaign in 2018. And I expect he'll probably raise even more than that for this year's campaign. So if she's going to be competitive, she's going to have to raise a lot of money. And maybe she'll be able to with the establishment support that she has. But there is no national organization that focuses on state auditor races on the Republican side. So there, it's not likely that some other group will come in and just spend a couple million dollars trying to get her elected.
And Republican Brenna Byrd made an announcement last week in Iowa. She said she's going to seek a rematch against Democratic Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller. Now, she is the Guthrie County attorney, and there's a backstory here between her and Miller. Let's talk about that.
Yes, I think this is really going to be one of the statewide races to watch, because the Republican Attorneys General Association is very active and very well funded. And the Republican Party put more than $500,000 behind Brenna Byrd's campaign for attorney general in 2010. She fell short that year. But I think that the outside groups between the state party and the national groups, I do expect millions of dollars to be poured into this attorney general race. In 2010, Brenna Byrd was fairly green. She had worked on the state legislative staff, and then she had worked on Congressman Steve King's staff. She'd been his chief of staff, but she really hadn't done much litigation. She hadn't been in private practice much. And so she didn't have a lot of experience. And so even though 2010 was a really good year for Republicans up and down the ballot, she fell about 11 points short against Tom Miller. But now she's had 4 years that she worked as senior legal counsel in Governor Terry Branstad's office. Now she's also worked for 5 years as a county attorney. And so she comes to the job with a lot more experience. And again, she's going to have the funding. So we'll have to see what Tom Miller, of course, Tom Miller has the strong name recognition from being elected 10 times, including sometimes in Republican landslide years. So I expect it to be a very competitive race.
He is the longest serving attorney general in U.S. history. Tom Miller is first elected in 1978, served until 91 when he left office after losing the Democratic gubernatorial primary, then reelected AG in 94. So he's been around a long time. With the money coming in, with the focus on this race by Republicans, do you think he's vulnerable?
I do. I think he is, especially if they spend a lot of money. I mean, as I said, the Republicans, they didn't spend a lot on the attorney general's race in 2014. And then in 2018, they didn't even nominate a candidate against Tom Miller, which I thought was kind of amazing. But Brenna Byrd, she has a lot of very strong establishment connections. So she has those connections with Governor Reynolds and former Governor Branstad from working on their staff. The National Attorney General's Association, as I mentioned, is very active. She also, because she worked on the staff of Steve King, she's got a lot of support on the far right of the Republican Party. And I think that this could be a year. I mean, as we've seen in midterm elections, that they often go against the president's party. And so that could indicate that it's a good year for Iowa Republicans. So I think it'll be competitive. But Tom Miller, he does have strong support. Traditionally, he has very strong support among independents. And I think that will be the challenge for Brenna Byrd, because right now her campaign rhetoric is very much geared toward the Republican base. But as she goes toward the general election, I'll be curious to see whether she shifts that a little bit, because Tom Miller has a strong brand with Iowans.
We need to shift focus here and talk about the coronavirus, as we have for so many weeks here on this broadcast. There was a sharp spike in positive coronavirus cases and deaths in Iowa reported. 161 more people were said to have died in the state due to the virus last week. And that brought to 8,019, the total number of people dead from the virus since the pandemic began. But on Monday, 32,732 positive cases of the virus were reported in the past 7 days. An increase of about 8,000 since Friday. The state's 14-day positivity rate is 20% now. Not good news, just not good news at all.
It's shocking numbers. I want to say, as we've mentioned before when talking about the coronavirus death statistics, that not all of those 160 deaths occurred in the last week. Those were deaths that happened over a period of about 2.5 months. But there is a big time lag. And so we have been seeing dozens of Iowans die every single week. And with the hospitalization numbers where they are, it's very possible that we're losing at 100 or more Iowans a week right now. These testing numbers are kind of hard to believe, the number of positive tests. I mean, it used to be that even 4,000, 4,000 or 5,000 positive tests in a week was a large number. Now we've averaged over the last week about 4,500 positive tests a day. And that doesn't include all of the home-based tests where people may or may not be reporting their positive results to any authority. So it's not a good situation. This Omicron variant is extremely contagious. A lot of people, even who are fully vaccinated and boosted, have been infected. Fortunately, those cases tend to be mild, but we're seeing that there are still a lot of Iowans who are either not fully vaccinated or have suppressed immune systems for one reason or another. And so those people are very vulnerable. And that's why a lot of national public health authorities are encouraging people to wear masks and take other steps, in addition to getting vaccinated, take other steps to try to reduce the spread of that virus.
886 patients were said to be hospitalized with the virus in Iowa on Monday. 74% of those hospitalized, not vaccinated. The message just doesn't seem to be getting out to those unvaccinated people, does it? Or maybe it's just falling on deaf ears.
And this is an extremely high hospitalization number. I mean, the last time Iowa's COVID hospitalizations were close to the 900 mark, where it was in early December of 2020, really high. And the number of COVID patients in the ICU, according to the state's website today, is 190. That is an extremely high number. I mean, even 150, historically through this pandemic, 150 Iowans in the ICU is high. So there just are not a lot of hospital beds right now. And I keep seeing healthcare providers and hospital executives pleading with people to be careful careful. And even just in their daily lives, I mean, now is not a good time for people to be taking risks that might get them injured and needing hospital care, because more than likely there won't be a bed for you.
And while all this was going on, Iowa's labor commissioner said late last week the state is not going to adopt or enforce the Biden administration's vaccine and testing requirements for big employers. That decision in Iowa came just before the requirement was set to go into effect to employers. And as the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments about those requirements, how can Iowa get away with this?
Well, Iowa is one of the states that has its own OSHA organization. And a lot of states have the federal government handle that function for them, but Iowa has its own agency, and that's been criticized for many years. People, especially in the labor community, have complained that Iowa OSHA isn't very aggressive in enforcing some of the workplace safety things, and that has certainly been a recurring theme during this pandemic. But it's an open question whether Iowa can say that we're not going to enforce this federal mandate. There were federal officials who said, no, actually, yes, you are going to. And so the federal government may take this to court if Iowa and other states decide to not enforce the mandate. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court, I did listen to part of the oral arguments on Friday morning, and it sounded like this mandate for vaccines for employers with more than 100 employees, that one, it sounded like the U.S. Supreme Court is going to strike down. We don't know exactly when. It seemed more possible that the mandate required, the requirement for healthcare workers to get COVID-19 vaccines, that seemed like that one might survive, but not the one for all larger employers. But in theory, if that mandate survives and the federal government takes Iowa to court, Iowa could end up being fined, or Iowa businesses or agencies that have more than 100 employees who don't enforce that vaccine mandate could end up paying big fines back to the federal government later.
We have about 2.5 minutes left. The Ankeny School Board voted to require coronavirus vaccines of its staff members last week, but there's been a late change on that.
Yes, the Ankeny and many school boards are meeting tonight, and I was following on Twitter. Todd Brady, who's a Democratic candidate for state senate in Ankeny, was tweeting from the school board meeting that they changed course, that after Iowa OSHA announced on Friday that they're not going to enforce this mandate, the Ankeny school board said that they are not going to do that either, and that if things change depending on the decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, they may call a special meeting later to reconsider that decision. But for now, Ankeny school district staff are not required to be vaccinated for COVID-19.
You broke the story on Bleeding Heartland on Monday that GOP Iowa Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks has been fined again for not wearing a mask in the U.S. House of Representatives. Tell us more, please.
Yes. Yeah, so the House chamber, they still have rules that require members to wear masks. And the sergeant at arms reported to the House Ethics Committee in late November that Marionette Miller Meeks had violated this rule. She violated it for the first time last May and was fined $500. The second violation is a $2,500 fine that comes right out of her salary. And she did not appeal. So that what was announced today, the House Ethics Committee announced that she had not appealed this fine during the deadline that she has for challenging. So it is going to go into effect. So that's $2,500. They didn't specify exactly what the violation was, but I believe the reference was for when Marionette Miller Meeks was seated behind the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, in November. He gave a very long speech trying to obstruct progress on a Democratic spending bill. And during that time, she was seated in the row just behind him, and she was not wearing a mask, and all of the members around her were wearing masks.
Less than 1 minute. What do you expect in the state legislature? It's going to settle down later in the week, but what will you be looking for this week?
Yeah, this week, I'm just going to continue to watch what new bills are filed. Nothing big is going to happen on taxes until later in the session. So I'm really looking at what the new bills that different members are filing, that ones including things that have to do with education, but also issues like abortion and LGBTQ equality.
And of course, we've got the governor's condition of the state and the condition of the court addressed coming this week.
Yes, that happens on Wednesday. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will be speaking on Wednesday to members of both chambers.
We'll be talking about all of that next Monday night. Laura, thank you. It has been a great show. Thanks for being part of it again.
Absolutely. The legislative session is the most exciting time of year.
I can see you're excited already. We are out of time. You have been listening, she really is, to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI. or its staff. Laura and I will Zoom right back here, literally, in this time slot next week. We'll have the latest on what's going on politically inside and outside the state capitol. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week. Until then, thank you so much, as I said.